You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi there. Welcome to the Dr. Nina Show, Outsmart Emotional Eating. I am your host, Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin. I'm a psychoanalyst specializing in food psychology, and I am here to help you wake up and think about your day, not your diet. I used to be the poster child for eating disorders, and I broke free, and now I help people all over the world create a binge-free, happy life. And on this show, I am here to help you too. So today, we're going to talk about going from dieting to thriving, how to find food freedom, how to find what I call liberation. If I have time, I'll open up the phone lines to callers. If you are on the Instagram live stream, feel free to just leave a comment in the comment box. Okay, so let me ask you something. How many diets have you tried in your life? One study found that by the time the average woman is 45 years old, she will have tried, are you ready for this? 61 diets. By the time the average woman is 45 years old, she will have tried 61 different diets. The diet industry is a $60 billion a year industry, and business is booming. According to the CDC, nearly half of all Americans are on a diet. That's about 162 million dieters. The UK is about 13. UK has like 13 million dieters. Australia has about 3 million dieters. And that is only three countries. So men, well, actually more, because the UK is more than England, but you get my drift, right? So yet many studies show that despite all of this dieting, most people will regain the weight they lose within 2 years. And recent research showed that after 5 years, 50% of dieters were 11 pounds over their initial weight that they were before they started dieting. And here's another interesting fact. Even though millions of people are dieting, obesity levels keep rising. And that is because diets fail for both biological and psychological reasons. So weight loss diets can be super restrictive. And when you take in too few calories, your body becomes more efficient. So your metabolic rate decreases, which means it requires fewer calories just for maintenance. So when you stop dieting, now your body's more efficient. You need fewer calories just to keep going through your day. And it is easier to regain that weight. And the cycle continues, right? You regain the weight. Oh my gosh, go on another diet. Rinse and repeat. And also, dieting may actually contribute to weight gain in the long run. It's crazy, right? Dieting makes you gain weight. There are scientific studies that show that dieting makes you gain weight more easily. In fact, in a study of over 2,000 sets of twins, where one was dieting and one wasn't, yes, they were actually able to find 2,000 sets of twins where one was dieting and one wasn't, which is amazing in itself, then the dieting twin was more likely to become overweight than the non-dieting twin. So I'm making the case for why dieting is no good. It makes you actually gain weight. Something else, artificial sugar makes us gain weight. If you've ever heard that artificial sugars can make you gain weight, you're right. It's true. Even though the diet soda and artificially sweetened foods and drinks are marketed as weight loss tools, studies show they actually can lead to weight gain instead. And by the way, this is not new news. It's not new. Researchers have known about it for decades. Back in the 70s, there was a study of over 32,000 nurses, and it showed that those who used saccharin, because that's what they had back in the day in the 70s, they gained more weight than those who didn't use artificial sweeteners and just used sugar. And in the 80s, the American Cancer Society studied about 80,000 women and found that those who used artificial sweeteners gained more weight overall or were heavier than those who didn't. A study also in the 80s called the San Antonio Heart Study found that people who regularly drank artificially sweetened drinks had a higher BMI than those who didn't. So the next time you reach for a diet drink, remember, it will not actually help you. It will actually hurt you. Also, not all calories are equal. You may have heard that losing weight is a matter of calories in, calories out, and all calories are equal. And that's the idea that as long as you expend more calories than you take in, it doesn't matter what you're eating. A calorie is a calorie is a calorie is a calorie. But in reality, our bodies are very complex and not everyone responds the same way. I once treated a woman who was, she was on Weight Watchers. And they use the point system instead of calorie counting or macro counting. And she used most of her points on processed foods. She would get Weight Watchers cookies, Weight Watchers protein bars. Everything was in the points. She was in the points, but she was just eating all this processed crap, really. But she believed that as long as she stayed within those points, that she would lose weight. But not only did she not lose weight, she felt sluggish. She felt tired. That scale did not budge. And it wasn't until she started using her points on actual real food, fresh whole foods, that she began feeling better and losing weight. And this goes to show that the quality of the food you're eating is just as important as the number of calories in it. You can eat 150 calories of ice cream, or you can eat a banana, but your body gets much more nutrition from the banana. So counting calories is not an effective tool for weight loss. When it comes to dieting, it is important to remember that most of our commonly held beliefs are actually myths perpetuated by the $60 billion diet industry that wants us to keep dieting. If diets work, we would go on a diet, we'd be done, and never diet again. That doesn't work for an industry that relies on people to be dieting. So it doesn't work that way. Diets don't work. Artificial sweeteners can cause weight gain, and not all calories are equal. A researcher, Dr. Tracy Mann from the Mann Lab at the University of Minnesota, it's a psychology lab that studies the self-control of eating. She said it's only the rate of weight regain, not the fact of weight regain, that appears open to debate. So it's not, you know, it's not if you're going to gain weight, it's how fast. Also, stress and weight gain. By the way, first I'm telling you the bad news, right? Then I'm going to give you some strategies on how to thrive, right? From deprivation, which is dieting, to thriving. We're going to talk about the thriving part in just a little bit. Stress and weight gain are also linked. When we're under stress, our bodies release a hormone called cortisol, which has been linked to weight gain around the stomach. And basically, cortisol makes glucose more readily, which then gets stored as belly fat. Not ideal. Nobody wants that. One study followed a group of dieters who had the same number of calories on this very specific meal plan. And some of the people counted calories and knew exactly what was in their meals, and some of them didn't. But both groups of dieters were more stressed while dieting, even though one group actually didn't know they were really dieting, right? They didn't really know that they were on diets. They just thought they were on a food plan. So even being on a diet, whether you even know you're on a diet or not, that causes stress. And stress can actually lead to weight gain. So if diets cause stress and stress causes weight gain, then going on a diet may not be the best way to lose weight. Understatement of the year, right? Again, the study was done by Tracy Mann, who I just told you about. She said stress can't be avoided when you're dieting because dieting itself causes stress. So what is the solution? Managing stress is key. Finding ways to reduce stress levels can help keep cortisol levels in check and prevent you from gaining weight. And not dieting is also key. So let's talk about how to manage stress. But first, let's talk about some traditional ways to manage stress. Like exercise, it's a great option. It boosts your mood. It also helps you sleep better, which in turn reduces stress levels. Prioritizing tasks so you don't look at your to-do list and get completely overwhelmed and freaked out. Just look at a list and pick three things. Those are just the three things I need to do, and then prioritize them. One, two, three. That can help you feel more in control, less overwhelmed. Spending time with friends, being with people you love and who love you, it's also a great way to deal with stress and feel less stressed. Other options, again, these are all traditional techniques to diminish stress, is listening to calming music, getting enough sleep. Again, everyone's needs are different. It's important for you to realize, like, what is it that you need? What is your best stress reliever? And do that. And guess what? Having fun is a great stress reliever. Have you heard of laughter yoga? Now we're into the untraditional, okay? Laughter yoga. I love this. It's pretty cool. It involves laughing for the sake of laughing while doing yoga poses. But you know what? You don't need to do the yoga pose. You can just laugh. You can just find a way to laugh. Like, I'm laughing now. I'm very happy. I'm not stressed. Okay. So doing things that make you laugh, that are fun, that are silly or goofy or whatever, just that lighten the load, right? That alleviates stress. Grounding techniques are another great option. Learning to be in the present moment, using the senses to kind of ground yourself in your environment in the moment. And they can really help you relieve those feelings of like, what's going to happen when you're just here and now. My favorite one that I use with my patients and my clients is what if versus what is. So what if is fear about the future, and that causes present day anxiety, stress about something that's not happening. So you're like, oh, what if that happens? Or what if that happens? Or what if that doesn't happen? Now you're thinking about the future, an event that has not happened, but you are feeling stressed in the present, which is horrible. So what to do? You stay with what is. So what if is about fear. It has to do with a future event that may or may not happen and likely doesn't happen. And if it does happen, you got to remember that you have the wherewithal to manage whatever it is that life's going to throw at you. But for the purposes of this exercise, remember, it's not happening. This is just your imagination. So to counterbalance what if thinking, which is a fear about the future, what is our facts about the present. So when you stay grounded in the present, this is what I know. The thing that I'm worried about, it's not happening. Just what do you know? What are the facts that you know in the present? And that helps diminish that anxiety and helps you really calm down. It's very effective. It's very reassuring. And you can also journal about all of this. Writing your thoughts and feelings really helps you process them and release them. It gets it out of you and onto the page. And it really reduces that anxiety and stress. Better to journal and sort through it than turn to food. Why some people don't want to journal is because it makes them think about the thing they don't want to think about. And when you're turning to food, you're not thinking about what you're worried about. Now you're just focused on, I can't believe I ate that, or what am I going to eat, or how much did I eat, right? It's a distraction from what may be bothering you. All right, so overcoming diet mentality. To overcome diet mentality, you first got to recognize diets don't work for all the reasons I just went over. Diets are not a sustainable solution for long-term health and wellness. They're just not. They lead to weight cycling. Weight cycling is basically yo-yo dieting, and that harms your physical health. It harms your emotional health. It does not help you to be in the diet binge cycle. It just makes you feel bad. It makes you feel bad about yourself. It makes you feel bad about your body. And if you feel bad, but you don't have ways of making yourself feel good and supporting yourself, you're going to use food to comfort yourself or escape your mean voice. So again, weight cycling, yo-yo dieting, that's the process of repeatedly losing and then regaining weight. Strict diet, right? Then returning to your old eating habits and gaining the weight back. And you know, that's why it's called the diet binge cycle. Weight cycling can also have negative effects on your physical and mental health. It increases risk of diseases, it affects your metabolism, and it really affects your self-esteem. Remember, that scale, that bathroom scale, that piece of metal and plastic, that cannot measure your self-worth. It is not a good measure of you. You've got to measure your self-worth and your self-esteem in other ways than through a number. So challenge diet culture just by noticing the message promoted by the diet culture and questioning them. The diet industry sells the illusion that losing weight will help you gain a better life. By changing our bodies, oh, we'll change our lives. By changing our bodies, we'll change other people. That person doesn't like you. They're not interested in you. Oh, just lose weight. Then that person will come around. This is the illusion that the diet industry sells. It is a false promise. So reframe your mindset around food and your body by practicing intuitive eating. Intuitive eating involves listening to your body's fullness and hunger signals and eating in a way that feels satisfying and nourishing. Now, this is very hard if you're struggling with binge eating. So if you're struggling with binge eating, this is more of a goal that you want to get to when you have processed and healed a lot of the emotional reasons why you're eating. It's pretty difficult. I found it's pretty impossible for most people to eat intuitively when they're also struggling with binge eating. And then they just feel bad because they can't eat intuitively. So now they feel bad about binging, feel bad about intuitive eating. So I'm here to say, hey, this is a goal, right? First goal is to identify and why you're eating, what's eating at you, learn new ways of responding to yourself. And then you can start thinking about intuitive eating. So but what is intuitive eating? Because this term is thrown around a lot. What is it? So again, it's not about deprivation. It's about listening to what whether you're hungry and listening to what your body needs. And that is not to say, oh, my body needs pizza. My body needs chocolate chip cookies. No, it's about really tuning into what your body needs for health with saying, hey, you know what, if you want to have cookies, have a cookie or two. But it's not like a license to binge. A lot of people think intuitive eating is essentially a license to binge. It is not. But what it does involve is giving up the good food, bad food mentality, which often translates into the good me, bad me mentality, which affects your self-esteem. I was good because I ate salad, or I was so bad I ate the brownie. In the world we live in, we should not feel good about ourselves because we ate a freaking salad. We ate salad. We ate lettuce. This is not cause to go like, oh, so good. Good for me. No. Feel good about yourself because you were kind to someone, or you challenged yourself, or you feel good about some quality that you possess. That is what you ought to feel good about, not that you ate, celery. How can you tell what your body needs? Is that like a craving? Okay. Well, I think that this would be a good time to, no, it's not, yes or no, it can be, but often when people talk about cravings, they're emotionally based and they think they're craving certain foods, but really they're craving some kind of comfort or distraction or something like this. So how can you tell what your body needs? It's a matter of tuning in to your body and listening. And if you have never listened to your body, it's going to be a process. And by the way, I don't teach people intuitive eating. As a psychoanalyst, I deal with the psychology of it, but I do I do have referrals to people who do help with intuitive eating. But again, it's something that you want to do after you have done the work of healing the emotional stuff. My food mood formula, which I have developed like in the first 10 years of seeing patients, I started noticing that there was a correlation between what they were eating and what their emotional needs were. So often when they said that they were eating, they were craving ice cream, it wasn't ice cream they were craving, it was comfort. When they were eating crunchy foods, they were often some form of anger, frustration, anger, irritation, rage, something was going on with them and they were crunchy. So anything with a crunch, anything that makes you crunch down hard, that can be associated with forms of anger. So you want to think about that. Filling foods, pizza, pasta, bread, cake, muffins, anything that takes up space is associated with loneliness and filling a void. So this is my signature food mood formula that I developed after 10 years of really correlating. Yes, Jenny craves crunchy. Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad. I am so glad that you have found it helpful. It's in the book. I'm actually writing a whole book on the food mood formula to kind of expand on that. And of course, people ask me about chocolate. Well, chocolate is, some of us only like chocolate with creamy centers. That's associated with creamy comfort. Some of us only eat chocolate if it has nuts or dark chocolate. Those are both have a lot of crunch. So that is associated with the crunchy. And if also consider, do you need more sweetness in your life? Okay. Not the sweetness that comes from sugar, but that sweetness of fulfillment, of love, of connection, all of that. You can't wait to read it. I can't wait to write it. I'm about halfway through though. First comes the binge cure journal. That's coming soon. So after that, I'm going to work on the food mood formula book. But so really be curious about not what you are eating, but why. Why am I eating this? Even if that food mood formula doesn't fit what you think, still be curious. What's going on with me? What am I feeling? What am I distracting myself? What would I be in touch with? What would I be thinking about if I were not thinking about food or if I were not eating? And if you eat something, get mad at yourself because you just ate whatever, or you just binged, ask yourself, if you weren't mad at yourself for binging, who or what might you be upset with? Right? Want to really get into what's going on inside instead of focusing on what you are eating. What is eating at you? That's our question. And then when you really heal that, when you can cultivate new ways of responding to yourself, which means first you identify what's going on, use the food mood formula if you need to, then you express it. You express what you are feeling and wanting. That's where journaling can come in handy. And then you respond to yourself. It's not enough to just identify it. A lot of people will say to me, well, I realized I was angry and then I still binged. I'm like, yeah, you realized you were angry. You identified that you were angry. Great, great job of the great first step. But what about the second and third step? Second step is say why you're angry, write it, journal it, talk to someone. Why were you angry? And by the way, don't turn it on you. Why were you angry with someone else? What's going on? Is there sadness under that anger? What's going on with you? And third is when you use my VARI acronym, validate, acknowledge, and reassure yourself. Because it's not enough to just go, I'm angry, express, 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 and then you're just left. So now you have to respond to yourself. Okay, yeah, I'm angry. Of course I am. How could I not be? This, this, and this, and this are going on. Of course I'm upset. And even if no one else understands and I don't really understand it myself, I'm going to honor that I'm upset. And then you reassure yourself. This is temporary. I will get through this. I've been through tough things in the past. I have the capacity to get through this too. Let me think about what I want to say, if anything. Let me think about what I want to do, if anything. It's going to get better. Right now it sucks, but I know that I'm going to get through it. Right? That helps you feel better. And ultimately, that becomes what you do to deal with your inner world rather than turn to food. So learning to trust your body, which might seem like a foreign concept, learning to trust your body means connecting to your body's natural cues and learning to trust them. We are born knowing what our bodies need. You know, when my kids were little, I would offer them, like if they wanted a snack, I'd say, well, do you want an orange or a cookie? As if they were both equal foods. And you know what? Most of the time they said they wanted the orange. You know, you want ice cream or, you know, a salad. Yeah. A lot of times they say, no, I want the salad, because they were intuitively eating. We are socialized by diet culture to lose touch with what our bodies need and want. And the key with being intuitive is to learn to listen again. A lot of times people don't even know they're hungry. When you've struggled for decades with food, you don't even know often when you're hungry. Like, physical hunger and emotional hunger just become all mangled together. So learning the difference between physical hunger and emotional hunger, which, by the way, physical hunger is physical. You feel it in your body, your stomach gurgles, you get lightheaded. I lose my words. They're gone. But it's something like where you feel it in your body. And physical hunger is located in your body. Emotional hunger is located in your mind. Oh, that food looks good. That sounds good. If I eat that, I'm going to feel better, right? And distinguishing between, are you physically hungry or emotionally hungry, is also really important. So let go of the idea that restricting certain foods is necessary to manage your health. You know, distinguish between physical and emotional hunger. One other reason that people turn to food when they're not hungry is for energy, right? So many of us, when we're tired and we need energy, we eat something sugary to wake up. But what we really need is rest, not food. Eating sugary snacks may give you a quick energy boost, but it won't last long. It's not the healthiest option. And most important, it's not what your body needs. Now, you may not always be able to go lie down or take a nap, but you can give yourself like a 5-10 minutes. Just, okay, let me just rest for a while. Give yourself what you need. Don't battle your true needs. When you're tired, when you're burned out, when you're sleep deprived, you don't need chocolate. You don't need food. You need rest. And, you know, think about it. When our kids are tired, if you have kids or if your pets are tired, and you don't say, wake up. You should be awake. You have things to do. We say, oh, take a nap, enjoy. Yeah. When did we stop doing that for ourselves? Let's regain that ability to identify what we need and meet what we need. Okay. So let's also talk about deprivation. We all know that when we can't have something, we want it even more. That's why when we deprive ourselves of our favorite foods, we end up overeating or binging on them. Research shows that dieters have increased cravings for forbidden snacks. One dieter said when she's on a diet, she wants ice cream every day instead of just once a week when she's not on a diet. So the anticipation of deprivation, going on a diet and not being able to have it, or the experience of deprivation, you're on the diet and you can't have the thing, only makes you want it more. We want what we cannot have. But what's interesting is that when people are given permission to eat their forbidden foods, I mean, true permission, they will often eat less of them. In one study, participants were told to eat what were described as addictive foods. They're addictive foods, the foods they were addicted to. and they actually ate less instead of more. This is a study where they were trying to prove food addiction, right? They're trying to prove the existence of food addiction, and they figured, hey, we're going to give these addicts, these food addicts, we're going to tell them to eat their addicted foods, the foods they're addicted to, and they're going to start and they're not going to stop. Instead, they ate less, which, you know, initially confused the researchers, but then they realized it was not about some brain situation. It's not like we're just mindlessly eating sugar because our brains are addicted to it. It's more about our minds. It's psychological. It's if you can't have it, you want it more. If you can have it, you can decide whether you want it, and if so, how much to have of it. And again, my personal experience with my kids on Halloween is a great example of this. If you've listened to the show, you've heard this before, but hey, you can hear it again. So I'll make it short. My daughter's friend was not allowed to eat sugar. Like, her parents literally thought it was poison. So we were going trick-or-treating without the parents, and she was sneaking so much sugar because she knew that as soon as she got home, her candy was going to be confiscated. So she ate so much, she actually ended up with a stomachache. She ended up feeling really sick. And that's one example of how deprivation makes us overeat. So trying to control our intake of certain foods does not work. It has the opposite effect, and it makes you want more. Allowing yourself or your kids to make their own choices actually leads to making better choices. On that same Halloween night, my daughter got really hungry, and she knew she could have candy. You know, she had like a king size pillowcase full of candy, and my husband was like, "Just have some candy," and she said, "No, I want some real food." Proud moment for me. Yeah, she really was an intuitive eater because she could trust that she could know what her body wanted or didn't want, instead of feeling deprived like her friend was. So she was, you know, the friend was eating out of deprivation. And this is possible for you. It doesn't matter how long you've been in the diet binge cycle. It may seem impossible, but as Nelson Mandela said, it is only impossible until it is done. So it's a matter of creating some change in the way you think about food and the way you think about yourself. And the way you think about why you are eating, instead of focusing on what you are eating. When you stop dieting, when you work through the underlying psychological reasons for binging or overeating or emotional eating, and when you cultivate an intuitive approach to eating and really trust your body, you will naturally be drawn to healthy, nutritious food. And you will also have chocolate or sweets or whatever it is in moderation and enjoy them more. It's hard to enjoy cake when you're eating it as fast as you can and you're just having another sliver, and then you're eating it really fast, secretly hating yourself, feeling shame, feeling guilt, berating yourself. What's wrong with me? Why can't I stop eating this stupid cake? Okay, I'll just have one more slice. That is not a pleasant experience. It's torture, actually. What is a pleasant experience is saying, you know what? I'm going to have a piece of cake and I'm going to enjoy it. And then you take a bite of the cake, and if it's good, you have some more. And if you're like, I thought it was going to be better, I don't think I'm going to eat this cake. That can happen too. When you trust that you can have cake anytime you want. You really will have it in moderation. And so many people have said this to me. They said, oh my God, you know, when I couldn't have Snickers, I would have them, like I would binge on Snickers all day long. I had like 20 Snickers in one day. And then when this person had permission, really like work through why the Snickers and all the associations to it, and learn new ways of identifying feelings and processing feelings and responding to themselves, then they had a Snicker. Or no, they had a bite of Snickers. And what they said was, wow, this doesn't taste as good as I remember. When it was forbidden, Snickers were great. When it was allowed and they could actually taste it more and decide, oh, kind of tastes Not great. I hear this all the time. Can happen to you too. Okay, so again, look at what's eating at you, because a lot of people think they are triggered by food, triggered by ice cream, bread, pasta, cake, you know, whatever is usually off limits, but we're usually not triggered by food. We are triggered by situations, thoughts, and emotions that we may not be aware of, and we use food as a solution. A solution. Eating is a solution to the problem. It is not the problem. The solution is that we are comforting, distracting, displacing, numbing, filling a void, and more. So how can what's hidden from us? Sometimes it's hidden from us. We don't know that we're feeling this. All we know is that we can't stop eating whatever's in the kitchen. So I want to give an example of how hidden ideas, what's hidden in our unconscious mind, can really strongly influence our behavior, even when we're not aware of it. So let me tell you about Danielle, not her real name. She couldn't get a handle on food. That's how she put it. She's like, I can't get a handle on food. I'm totally out of control. During the day, she was what she called good, meaning she ate healthy, she made good choices, and every night after dinner, she would end up reaching for a bag of chips. And she didn't eat chips during the day. She didn't care about chips during the day. But at night, when she was reading books with her husband, when the day was done and after dinner, they would settle down and read books. Suddenly, she would feel this strong craving for chips. So what was going on? What's going on here? Well, it turns out, what was Danielle reading? Right. That was my first question. What's the trigger? Maybe there's something about what she was reading that was causing this need to eat crunchy food. Well, she was reading 50 Shades of Grey, which triggered some very complicated feelings and conflicts about intimacy, trust, and control, but not in a sexual way. The reality was Danielle did not want to read books every night after dinner, but she felt obligated to because her husband wanted to. He had set up this idea of like, hey, this is an idea. Let's like give up TV for a year. Forget TV. It like addles our minds. Let's read books and become smarter and enriched. And she, not wanting to disappoint him, went along with it. But she didn't really want to go along with it. She wanted to Netflix and chill. So her resentment, which she couldn't even recognize herself because she felt so guilty, triggered her to crave chips as a way to distract her from her feelings. So instead of being upset with her husband for imposing this no TV rule, although he didn't think he was imposing it, he just thought it was a good idea that she'd agreed on. But instead of being upset with her husband, she got mad at herself for eating chips. So the lesson here is that our cravings and habits often have deeper roots than we realize. They have deeper roots than we realize. It's not about willpower. It's not about control. It's not about food addiction. Danielle and others like her may have an addiction, if we're going to use that word. I don't love that word. But the addiction is not to food. It's to the use of food, right? She wasn't addicted to Doritos. She was addicted to using Doritos as a way to distract herself from her feelings, not to the actual substance of chips. So it's more of an eating addiction, if we're going to use the word addiction, which again, I don't like the word addiction because I think it sounds very negative and pejorative. But as you can see, she wasn't addicted to chips because you know what? When she talked to her husband and had a very honest conversation with him, he was sort of like, oh my God, I didn't know you feel that way. And they were able to do a compromise. You know, it was like 3 days reading or I don't know. They worked it out so that it was equal. And some days they watched TV and sometimes they read books. And she stopped eating chips. So how about that? Wasn't in her brain. It was in her mind. So the next time you want to eat when you're not hungry, ask yourself, what's going on with you? What was happening right before you thought about food? consider your thoughts and emotions. If you were not thinking about food, if you were not worrying about your weight, what would be on your mind? What are you distracting yourself from by focusing on food and then focusing on the fact that you ate food and then beating yourself up? And now you're just, you know, self-attacking, turning on yourself. If you couldn't do that, what would be on your mind? All right, so let me just actually debunk the food addiction myth, since I just talked about how much I hate the word addiction. So look, we've all heard of addiction to coffee, alcohol, cigarettes, you know, all the things, drugs. And a lot of people say they're addicted to Instagram. They're addicted to their phone. They're addicted to bad relationships. It seems like everything's an addiction. But what does it actually mean to be addicted? And is it possible to be addicted to food? No. So traditionally, addiction is seen as the compulsive use of a substance that the user knows is harmful, traditionally. And there's an increased tolerance to the substance, meaning that more and more and more is needed to feel the same effect. And then when you withdraw the substance, you feel withdrawals. So does this apply to food? Can someone really be addicted to food? Well, many people who struggle with food, especially, you know, sugary and processed foods, they feel like addicts. But unlike addictions to coffee, cigarettes, or alcohol, where you could stay away from that substance to survive, we cannot stop eating. We can't just remove the addictive substance. Again, it's not really an addictive substance, but it feels that way. So we need food to survive, which means we have to find a different way of coping with the stress in our lives, the feelings that we have, all the things, without using food as a way of comforting, distracting, rewarding, or whatever it is that you're using it for. Now, there are some studies that suggest that certain foods, like those that are high in sugar and fat, activate the release of dopamine in our brains. Dopamine is the chemical that mediates pleasure and motivation. So food addiction theory suggests that changes in the brain from eating those foods are evidence of addiction. Not so fast. Lots of things change our brains. Listening to music changes our brains. Therapy changes our brains. Relationships with other people change our brains. Having fun changes our brains. Anything pleasurable has an effect on our brains. So there are also lots of studies that refute the idea of food addiction completely. One popular argument for the food addiction theory is that some studies show that rats, when given a choice between sugar and heroin, rats will choose sugar. Therefore, it must be addictive. It's more addictive than heroin. It's more addictive than cocaine, which is another study. No, this is not surprising. Rats eat for survival. They are not interested in getting high. Rats are always going to choose sugar over heroin because they're eating for survival, and sugar is food. So ultimately, with feeling out of control, it is not about our brains. Our minds play a huge role in quote unquote addiction. So while food addiction may seem like a real thing, the truth is more complicated than that. I actually co-edited a book called Beyond the Primal Addiction, in which, you know, every contributor talked about different addictions, and the commonality of all these addictions is that they are ways of coping. Whatever the addiction is, it's a way of coping with something painful, uncomfortable, difficult. So let me give you also an example really fast. We only have 5 minutes, but I think I can do it, of how emotional triggers lead to binging. So Annette, not her real name, single mom, felt like a sugar addict. She told me, like, oh no, I am a sugar addict. Sugar is my personal crack. That was actually what she said. She would even sneak cookie batter when she was making cookies with her kids, she would send them out of the room on some pretext so she could eat a bunch of cookie batter. But it really wasn't just about sugar, right? Annette was going through a tough divorce. She was stuck in an unsatisfying job. Eating sugary food gave her some kind of comfort and distraction from these problems. She didn't have enough happiness in her life. She turned to food instead for fun. So feeling addicted to food is more psychological than physical. And suddenly craving unhealthy foods, there's always a reason behind that. So it's about learning to recognize the true trigger, which has nothing to do with the substance of sugar or any other food. So for Annette, it was the lack of fun in her life, the lack of happiness in her life, the lack of satisfaction in her life that drove her to seek comfort and satisfaction in sugary treats. And when it comes to binge eating disorder, it is not about what you are eating. It's about why you are eating. And many people use food to deal with tough emotions, distract themselves from problems or issues they're facing in their life that they don't want to think about, or maybe not even letting themselves know what they don't want to know. So trying to restrict certain foods or follow a strict diet, that is not going to help you deal with the true root of your issue. That's like plucking a weed and thinking that it is not going to grow back. Unless you get to the root, which is underground, we can't see it. Just like in our minds, there are many unconscious thoughts that we have that are hidden from us. Thoughts, wishes, needs, wants, they're hidden from us. We're in the dark. But they affect so much of our behavior. Our unconscious minds are so powerful. But the good news is, by exploring the reasons behind our binging, instead of focusing on food, you can get a better understanding of what your true triggers are. The true triggers are the emotional states that lead to binging, or the thoughts. Thoughts lead to feelings, lead to behavior. If you only focus on behavior, nothing is ever going to change. That's a diet. But when you focus on, well, what are your thoughts? And how do you respond to your feelings? Then the behavior, either you won't do it or you do something else that's healthy. So, you know, knowing why, what are the true triggers that helps you take action and develop better coping mechanisms, better strategies for responding to your emotions without eating. And focusing on the why also takes the emphasis off of feeling guilty or ashamed about food, which is a big relief, right? When you're focusing on, oh my God, I can't believe I ate that. Oh my God. If people knew what I was doing with food, they would be horrified. They'd think differently of me. They wouldn't, oh, it's too mortifying. Now you're not thinking about what else might be bothering you. Now you're feeling mortified and embarrassed and ashamed about what you're doing with food. But when you say, okay, why am I doing this? If I weren't upset with myself, who would I be upset with? What would I be upset with? If I couldn't attack myself and focus on food and think about all these things, what would be on my mind? Let me be more curious about me. Then you are starting to heal yourself. You're approaching yourself with a more understanding and compassionate perspective. You're being a friend to yourself. So if you are struggling with food, it is really important to identify what's going on in your head and your heart. You know, emotional hunger does spark specific cravings. Losing weight and creating a healthy relationship with food is not about counting macros or having willpower and control. If diets were that simple, they would not fail so often. And by so often, I mean always. When you learn new ways of identifying what you're feeling, new ways of supporting and soothing yourself, you stop using food to cope with what's going on inside. It takes time, but it is possible. Remember, you learned this way of relating to yourself. You can learn a different way. It is possible. We have what scientists call brain plasticity. You know what that means? You can learn new stuff. You can learn new stuff. You can unlearn something and learn something new. So that is our show for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. I am Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, psychoanalyst, helping you to create a binge-free, happy life. I am here live every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific here on LA Talk Radio, or you can listen later wherever you get podcasts, including Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For a deeper dive into this topic and many others, check out my book, The Binge Cure, 7 Steps to Outsmart Emotional Eating. It is available on Amazon in every format, including Audible, in which I read it to you. Have a good day, everyone, or a good night if you're listening in England, as one of our listeners is, on Instagram. I will see you next week. Take good care. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.